The Mutual Broadcasting System presents STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. With today's briefing, here is retired Marine Intelligence Officer, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And I'm going to be talking about the status of two huge conflicts, wars, that are dominating the news, and respectively, what's happening in the Middle East with Iran and what's happening with Ukraine. And I'm going to try and avoid, I got to reference some of the headlines, but I'm going to try and get a little bit of backdrop as to what's going on, because it's very difficult to see either of these things, particularly what's happening in Iran. It's so difficult to see it without a political visor, if you will. And there's certainly enough people out there who are taking strong, polarized positions on the war, which tends to ignore some of the fundamentals behind what we're actually seeing. So anyway, on the weekend of August 1st, it appeared that the White House, the Trump administration, the U.S. was about to launch huge strikes on Iran, and that this was going to be a joint U.S.-Israeli operation. All right. And I say this because I had two very large news networks. Well, technically three, I guess, if you count Fox, but definitely two very large that have me on a short leash saying, hey, don't go anywhere. Are you around this weekend? Can we get hold of you? Can we call you in the middle of the night, sort of thing? And so, yes, that is an indicator of just how big these things were. Anyway, President Trump came out and said, hey, this is halt. I'm not going to do it. And he said this because there's been real progress in negotiations with Iran. Now, Iran, true to form, turned around and said, we're not doing any negotiations. We have no idea what they're talking about, which is, I have to tell you, they say that so often. I mean, in some cases, technically correct. They may not be talking directly to the United States, but they're talking to all these other countries that kind of act as our interlocutor, if you will, in discussing what's going on. So technically they can say that with a straight face, although they don't actually need anything even approaching the truth to keep a straight face from telling a lie. But with that said, they came around and immediately denied there was anything, trying to score political points. I'm sure something that's not missed by the White House. Now, Oman and Iran have been in negotiations for a while, and both these countries are the countries that border the Strait of Hormuz. That critical waterway, maritime choke point for the Persian Gulf, what Iran has been effectively blocking with missiles and drones and small boats and maybe mines. We're not entirely sure how much mining, if any mining is out there. That's been a big point of discussion. But those two waters are those two countries basically control those waters. Now, for those who don't know, Strait of Hormuz is pretty narrow. At one point, it's so narrow, or it's actually for a lot of it, it's so narrow that essentially these two countries have the Strait of Hormuz in their territorial waters, not their exclusive economic zones, definitely not in the high seas. These are their territorial waters. In other words, you get to the middle, in this side, you're in Iranian territorial waters. And on this side, you're in Omani territorial waters. And point of legal reference, if you're in territorial waters, that pretty much means you're in the sovereign territory, even though it's water, sovereign territory of that state that's recognized international law. However, it is also recognized international law that shipping has the right of innocent passage. As long as they're not doing something provocative or whatever, they can go right through that thing. And then the way it's been there is there's international sea lanes that go through both Omani and Iranian waters in the middle of the strait, and that's where the ships have always gone. And Iran has periodically tried to push that envelope by claiming that ships violated their territorial waters, occasionally taking ships and causing a great international crisis that we then have to resolve. Of course, in this most recent case, they've just claimed that they control the Strait of Hormuz. It's their strait, and they want to basically charge fees and force everybody to go up and around a couple of islands near Iran and charge them tolls or charge them a usurious special insurance rate for them to go through, which is basically protection racket money. And so anyway, A lot of discussion going on there. All right. But there is something to kind of look at there. There are lanes, and actually lanes have been modified since the war began. There is a southern Oman lane that goes right near the coast of Oman. Iran doesn't like this because it completely avoids Iranian waters altogether. And Iran wants all the ships to go up through Iranian waters so they can charge that toll. Well, not only does that one work, and it's actually got ships going both ways, but there's another lane that goes up closer to Oman. In other words, ships could go through Omani territorial waters without ever touching Iranian waters, just avoid those previous international sea lanes altogether, and just basically cut Iran out of the whole discussion. All right, so I don't know where this discussion is going to go, but it could end up that ships coming out of the Persian Gulf that are not coming from Iran would go through Omani territorial waters. And I'm sure that ships coming from Iran to and from would go through Iranian territorial waters. And that may be what the future holds. Nobody has said that yet. We have, the U.S. position is that the strait should be open. It should be open to international shipping. We'll see whatever comes of this, but that's a definite possibility. All right. So anyway, getting back to this operation, the proposed big strikes or strike operation was canceled, and it's still significant because it would have involved Israel. Israel hasn't been really involved in strikes here since the ceasefire stuff started. I say ceasefire because it seems to be on again, off again, but since it started, Israel's been pretty much out of the strike business against Iran for quite some time. However, a number of Gulf states have been reportedly engaged, not heavily, but engaged with doing strike operations against Iranian targets as well. So we've seen that. And the Gulf states have not been attacking Iran while the Israeli planes were attacking Iran. That's completely separate and apart. So, and it does cause problems for a number of these countries. You can imagine it'd be very difficult for Kuwait to be conducting airstrikes on Iranian territory at the same time Israel is conducting airstrikes on Iranian territory, because Kuwait does not recognize or have normalized relations with Israel. So that would be very difficult. Saudi Arabia would find it very difficult, if not impossible, politically speaking, because they do not have normalized relations with Israel either. Saudi Arabia is now very much engaged with the strike missions. In fact, some of the strike missions involve the U.S. They've been attacked by the Houthis multiple times, to include in Yanbu port. That's where the east-west pipeline, that major pipeline, oil pipeline, goes across the country into the Red Sea. That's where it terminates, and that's where they've been loading up ships, and those ships have been bypassing the Strait of Hormuz. If it's going to Europe or somewhere or anywhere else, it goes up through the Suez Canal, and if it was going to Asia, it would go down to the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Well, now the Houthis have threatened the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. They've been attacking in Iranian ports. They even went so far as to attack the east-west pipeline itself, trying to shut that whole thing down. And then there was a drone strike against Egypt, which hit a port very close to the Suez Canal, which is another way of saying, basically the Iranians indirectly saying, we could hit the Suez Canal and hit a ship in the Suez Canal. And you can imagine if a ship was hit in the Suez Canal during transit, that could cause major implications. We've seen what happens when a ship gets caught in the Suez Canal and they can't get it out of there. So that could cause enormous macroeconomic implications worldwide if that was to occur. So all of this is happening while this is going on. Saudi Arabia is dealing with this because they're being attacked. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia, they were also attacked from the north from the Shiite militia, Iranian proxies in Iraq. And the U.S. and Saudi Arabia jointly went in and hit them. Of course, the Iraqi government complained, as they would. But the Iraqi government is also working closely with the U.S. to try and get these Shiite militias to disarm and to quit being military, paramilitary elements. I don't know how that's going to work. I know one of them was kind of leaning that direction. It sounded like they had an agreement to go that direction. But there's more than one of these militias out there. So, and certainly with this latest thing that just occurred, I don't know how this is going to work at all. But that's all going in the background. So anyway, that's some of the things to be considered while all of this is happening. Also, there has been something of a rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia for a while. It's been widely reported. They do not see eye to eye on a number of things. They do not see eye to eye on a number of things with a number of countries. In some cases, they've been diametrically opposed on where they're going on this. But things are changing. You know, there were two major factions in Yemen, one the regular government, and then there was another faction towards the south. They have unified into a front. Now they control 80% of the Yemeni territory. Of course, the Houthis control the other part of the Yemeni territory. And they're now working together. And it appears that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are rapidly mending fences in that direction because they've got a common threat with Iran. They're both dealing with this threat, and they've got this common threat with the Houthis. They both had to deal with that in the past. So it looks like we're going to see more cooperation going that direction, which may have something to do with what's going to happen in the Persian Gulf. Just to remind everybody, there are three islands in the Iranian-controlled islands in the Persian Gulf at the on the Persian Gulf side of the Strait of Hormuz, right there. Some would say, if you're leaving, it'd be at the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz. Abu Musa, which is the largest island, and there's Greater Tumb and Lesser Tumb. Anyway, they are claimed as sovereign territory of the UAE. They were seized by the Shah of Iran back in 1971. Obviously, the UAE would like to get those back, and they don't necessarily have the ability to do that on their own, but I could see some interesting things happening with Saudi Arabia and the UAE working together on a number of things, particularly if the U.S. is involved with some of its sea lift capability. So there's interesting things there. By the way, this thing about hitting Egyptian territory, a lot of questions out there. Is Egypt going to get pulled into this whole thing? Could Egypt become militarily involved in this entire conflict? Don't know. But I will tell you, one of the reasons behind the postponement of the strikes is fear of the Iranians retaliating against critical infrastructure, gas, oil, but also desalination. And just a quick recap, I know you probably heard me say this before, 90% of the fresh water in Kuwait City is desalinated water. Kuwait has had one of its desalination plants and the power plant that keeps it going hit multiple times. Also, if you go down to Manama in Bahrain, that's pretty much all desalinated water. If you go into Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and the UAE, it's about 80%+ is desalinated water to keep these major Persian Gulf cities going. So the desalination plants is very vulnerable critical infrastructure, and they know, the Iranians know that, and they have no doubt the Iranians would target that. And you can imagine if those things were taken out, particularly in August, where you get temperatures of 100 to 130 degrees Fahrenheit, 130+ getting up to Kuwait. I know that from firsthand experience, that you would have this massive humanitarian crisis, particularly if they hit the power plants and hit the desalination plants, lack of water, lack of electricity for air conditioning. It would be a really, really difficult situation for everyone to handle. So anyway, that was part of the thinking, I think, with the Gulf states telling the U.S., please do not do these strikes. You know, part of it is, obviously, they're probably a little concerned about Israel stepping back in a major way. But the other part was that they were very concerned about what the Iranians would do in terms of retaliation. All right, let me switch gears here a little bit with Ukraine-Russia. Things are moving pretty fast, and I'm going to kind of give you more of a backdrop of this. The deep strikes that Ukraine is doing throughout Russia are having a huge effect. It is not uncommon to see headlines where the Ukrainians have hit over 1,000 miles within Russia, hitting a oil refinery or some other critical infrastructure, whether it's a drone production plant or something tied to their missiles or anything like that. This has become common every day. Hitting in and around St. Petersburg and Moscow has also become common. Interestingly, Russia is short of air defense systems as well, so they've been bringing back a lot of their missiles, like their S-400 systems, S-300 systems, in and around St. Petersburg and Moscow in order to protect those capital cities. But at the same time, they've left strategic sites all over the country uncovered. And the Ukrainians are very good at figuring out where their vulnerabilities are and then exploiting those. One of the areas that was really uncovered was the Sea of Azov, with all the shipping going back and forth, and they have really just decimated shipping going in the Sea of Azov. Of course, you may recall that they basically stopped the land bridge road that goes from Russia across southern Ukraine, the part they control, into Crimea. They've basically stopped that because of drone strikes. They've also hit that Kerch Bridge, which is a southern route. So as far as Crimea is concerned, it's become almost a logistical island. It's very difficult to get stuff across the Kerch Bridge. It's now become very difficult, bordering on impossible, to move stuff in and around the Sea of Azov without it getting hit. Always been difficult to move anything in the Black Sea. But the other part is that land bridge just isn't working for them. So things in Crimea are very critical. And Crimea was the crown jewel, if you will, of Russia's possessions in Ukraine. That's the one they've controlled since 2014. That crown jewel has now become a logistical Achilles heel. They were using it as a logistics base for supporting operations for the north. They can't do that anymore because they just can't get anything in there. And they're having a tough time just supporting what they have there. It's become very difficult for them to operate militarily. In Crimea, the Black Sea Fleet pulled out of Sevastopol some time ago. So it's a very difficult situation that they have there. And so that's become a problem. Since the war began back in 2022, February 2022, there has been this polite fiction that Russia has put out there. This is a special military operation. It's not a war. And Putin has put this out there. And for the longest time, he was able to kind of make it look like this was something far away. It doesn't impact Russia. It's not something that Russia has to deal with, even though he was incurring tremendous casualties with all of his operations, even though this was costing the economy enormously. As long as people just didn't see it, they could kind of pretend, and certainly there was a massive Russian security apparatus that would enforce them looking the other way, that this wasn't actually happening, but it was happening. Now they can't pretend. Now, literally, they will see smoke across the sky of Moscow, St. Petersburg, as refineries and oil facilities, gas facilities are being hit on a regular basis, along with other facilities. The Amazon delivery or warehousing system of Russia has been hit, which is not Amazon, it's another company, has been hit over and over again. And that's because the Russians were using it for logistics. So it was a dual use sort of thing. There's also a firm in Russia that competes with that firm that has also been hit over and over. Wildberry is the name of the firm I was thinking of. And so that's been, so they're seeing that, they're seeing disruptor from that. They've got these really long gas lines all throughout Moscow if they can get gas at all, and they have to pay enormous sums of money. So that has hit pretty much across the entire country. They're running into these massive gas lines, so they can't get gas. They're having a tough time, you know, having gas to get to work, to do other things. So it's having an enormous effect. The economy is plummeting. The ruble is losing its value everywhere. And places where Russians used to travel for vacation, they can't travel to vacation. Well, those places being Crimea, they obviously can't go there now. So it is causing enormous problems across the board for the Russians. Now, there are also reports coming out that the elites in Russia have become very, very frustrated with Putin. They don't see where this war is going. They're not seeing where Russia is going to win. Putin has created this information bubble for himself where he basically has generals reporting to him that they're making these battlefield gains, that they're taking villages and cities that they have not taken on the battlefield. That's been verified through satellite imagery. Institute for the Study of War has been very much focused on this, saying that they're making claims of taking places they didn't take. It's not clear if Putin even, you know, despite the fact he's a former intelligence officer, it's not even clear that he's even seeing past his own self-imposed level of deception, where he's deceiving himself. It reminds me a lot of what had happened around Hitler towards the end of World War II, where the generals were afraid to say anything that would upset Hitler. So they just tell him stuff. And at the end of the war, Hitler was in his bunker in Berlin as the Soviets are literally crashing into Berlin. And he's trying to move phantom armies and corps across the map. And his generals didn't want to tell him that these armies and corps no longer exist. They were destroyed by the Soviets. Anyway, long story short, that's where Putin is today. And he has created this situation. He is doing anything he can to recruit people to go. They're literally, you know, there was an expression in California back in the back during the gold rush that there were ships that would come to California. And when they come to California, the crews would jump ship and they go off and try to pan for gold. So you had these captains and they would try to get a crew. One of the ways they do it in San Francisco, I was just in San Francisco, but one of the ways they do it was they would call it Shanghaiing. And a Shanghai was that they would have stuff built under the floors where literally somebody would be sitting there playing cards, drinking, and then, or they'd be drinking and they might slip something in the drink and they'd pass out. Next thing you know, they wake up in the morning and they're on a ship headed out to Shanghai, so to speak, or heading out to China across the Pacific. That is not dissimilar to what Russian military recruiters are doing to Russians. They're arresting them. They're threatening them with imprisonment if they don't volunteer to join the Russian army. And when they join the Russian army, once they get on the front lines and they get into combat, the life expectancy of a Russian soldier, according to the director of the CIA, is about 20 to 30 minutes. So it is a horrific system that they're in right now. All right. And mid-2026, it's been estimated, about 500,000 Russian soldiers have been killed outright. They've had almost 1.4 going on 1.5 million battlefield casualties. And it is just, it really is phenomenal. It's almost unbelievable the amount of damage they've had. So what does this mean? Well, I'm going to give you a little historical perspective. It is now August of 2026. 35 years ago, it was August 1991. The Soviet Union was falling apart. You know, the Secretary General Gorbachev had introduced a couple of things, glasnost, basically this openness, if you will, trying to be more transparent, trying to make the Soviet society, the Soviet economy that wasn't working, try to work. It was having the opposite effect. The Soviet economy really wasn't getting any better. In fact, it was falling apart. The Warsaw Pact was completely falling apart. And the head of the KGB, amongst others, said, it's all Gorbachev's fault. And they tried to throw a coup to overthrow Gorbachev. Well, the coup failed. Gorbachev remained in power, but it was a very politically damaged Gorbachev that remained in power. And by December, the Soviet Union fell apart. I point this out because when I look at the situation of the Soviet Union back 35 years ago, one could argue that the situation in Russia now is far worse in many ways than what the Soviet Union was looking at 35 years ago. One could argue that. Some would say, no, there were fundamental flaws in the Soviet system that are more profound than what we see today in Russia. Yes, but there weren't drones landing in and around Moscow and St. Petersburg. There wasn't half the oil production of Russia getting shut down by drone strikes. There wasn't all these other issues going on that are happening now. And by the way, they hadn't sacrificed 1.5 million Russians and with 500,000 of them killed outright in this incredibly wasteful war. So one could argue that now the situation is much more profound. And I just kind of point that out with the elites giving up hope, that those that put Putin in power, basically throwing in the towel, is at least that's what's widely being reported, that they have just lost confidence and faith in what Putin can do. And they don't see a road ahead. And with the situation there, I just say I would pay a lot of attention to what's happening in Moscow right now. I'd pay a lot of attention to what's happening inside Russia. A little, you know, yes, it's horrific in Kyiv. It's horrific in Ukraine. They're getting hit with ballistic missiles all the time. But I would pay a very close attention to the political side of what's happening in Russia. If you look at what happened in 1991, if you look at what happened in 1917, when change happens in these autocratic systems, when it happens, it's very rarely a slow roll. It usually happens very quickly. If you will, the center cannot hold. And when the center can't hold, the whole thing collapses very fast. That's what I look for in Russia. If they get to the point where the center cannot hold, I don't know when that's going to happen. But when it gets to that point, I think things will change very quickly. I think the same might happen in Iran too. Again, more reports are coming out that the general populace of Iran is very, very frustrated. And whereas they don't want to go out on the streets and get killed as they did in January by the besieged militia and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, you know, upwards close to 50,000 of them were slaughtered in the streets. They might do it again. And by the way, if it happens again, the reports I'm seeing indicate that it will not be just protesting, that there will be violence against the regime itself. So it could be a very different thing. Hey, thanks for listening to Strat. And please visit stratpodcast.com. You can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kiffer TV, or you can go to my website at www.gripsa, G-R-I-P-S-A for Global Risk Intelligence Planning, gripsa.com. Also, I should mention on the 18th of August, if you go to the InfraGuard, Los Angeles InfraGuard website, that you can register for another one of my Global Threat Update webinars. So that's coming up very soon as well. So anyway, thanks again for listening and hope you tune in next time.
Strategic Risk Assessment Talk is presented by the Mutual Broadcasting System. Stay informed on the matters we discuss by visiting stratpodcast.com and other sites mentioned by Hal Kiffer. You may interact with the show through our website at stratpodcast.com or through our Facebook social media site. Thank you for joining us.